The Ashes has never been bigger, so you'll need a big podcast. Join me, Corbin Middlemass and Ed Cowan on ABC Cricket Podcast, Monday and Friday and after every day of play. Search for ABC Cricket Podcast on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
We are so delighted to share that Conversations is Apple Podcasts' number one podcast of 2025. Thank you for listening and reviewing the show and telling your friends about us. It really helps us to find new listeners, and we just love hearing what you love about the show in the reviews and on socials. And if you're a new listener to Conversations, welcome. We recommend that you check out our most shared episode of the year, my conversation with Jonathan Haidt on attention fracking and how to stop tech companies from stealing your child's focus. Or head over to the Conversations channel on Apple Podcasts, where we've brought some of the most memorable episodes from the last 20 years of the show and put them into themes like psychology and relationships, health and resilience, and in-depth conversations about how to adapt to the evolving world around us.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Louise O'Sullivan joined the Army Reserves at 17, and she went on to spend 10 years with the Australian Defence Force, with deployments in Afghanistan, Iraq, and all round the Pacific. But Louise wasn't there as a soldier. She was a psychologist, tasked with helping men and women who'd been up close to some of the worst things imaginable. Then, just a few years ago, Louise faced a life and death struggle all her own. She became a mum to Ivy and Flynn, twins who were born to a surrogate in Ukraine. Hi, Louise.
Hi.
You first got involved in the army as a reserve, as I say. Mm. What appealed to you about the army?
People I knew from growing up in Ipswich were joining, and I had an uncle growing up who had never been able to join the military but was always really interested in it, and he was our favourite uncle, so I think that was part of it, and it just seemed like quite an adventure.
The rules, the discipline, how did that suit your temperament as a teenager?
I have always loved a rule. I went through 12 years of Catholic education, and as a 16-year-old, this is so embarrassing, as a 16-year-old I kissed a boy, Dave, and then I went to the priest the next day and confessed, and I think he must have, on reflection as an adult, he must have just been rolling his eyes, like, calm down. But I felt a lot better having done my Hail Mary.
After your first introduction to the Army in the Reserves, you went and trained as a psychologist and then joined the military full time. So did you think that would mean sort of sitting in a consulting room in Canberra or actually being out in the field? What was your understanding of what the role of a psychologist in the Army might be?
I certainly thought it would be seeing more clients than I did when I was first posted to Canberra. And I definitely thought it would involve, far more getting out of the office. But my first posting was to a position that was really based around policy and procedure.
One of your first opportunities away from that kind of work was a deployment to East Timor, where you were helping soldiers with a process known as ripping out. What does that involve?
It's where they're leaving the country and they usually move to a new area to rest in place and prepare to leave. And during that time, they go through a return to Australia psychological screen, and that's what we would do with them.
And what's the intention or what's the goal of that for you?
It's all about understanding what their deployment was like for them. Was it meaningful? Was it boring? Was it traumatizing? How did their partner cope? What's their relationship like? How will they return both to their family, to normal life with their friends, as well as to their job back in Australia?
And how did soldiers generally feel about those sessions, about sitting down with a psychologist?
They don't want to go. They don't want to be there. And also, there's certainly always was a nervousness that if they were to tell you something significant, then it might impact their career and their future deployment possibilities. So that was definitely a barrier that you had to get through.
So were those sessions with you with a psychologist confidential in that setting?
Confidentiality is such an interesting term in the military because, to be fair, it exists in the sense that you're not going to give the nitty-gritty details of what is being said to anyone else, and you're not going to laugh about it at dinner parties and things like that. But there are so many caveats around if there is something that might affect their employability or deployability that you may need to disclose. And you would always let them know that we're nearing a topic like that. But realistically, if they tell you something that is a risk to them, a risk to someone else, or part of these notifiable incidents, then you absolutely have to disclose it.
So given that they couldn't trust that safety net of complete privacy, what did you learn about how to make soldiers feel comfortable with you, trust you, and share things in a way that was going to be helpful to them?
Yeah, I think you had to be very relatable, very conversational. So not asking really standardized questions and making it feel as though this was a formal kind of interview. I used to have a process where I would try and, get up really early every morning, go and do PT so that people saw me out doing that. And I would often find that that's where people would come up and tell me things. Maybe they would be worried about a friend, or maybe they wanted to let me know about something else. So I don't know how much actual weights I was getting done. But that was really good ground to break down barriers and boundaries with people.
So being seen and being approachable outside of the consulting room is
absolutely
a big part of where your work got done. So you continue doing various deployments as a psychologist with the regular armed forces. How did the opportunity to work with the special forces come about?
So when you're in the military, you generally move jobs every 2 to 4 years, and there's a process whereby you are kind of ranked with your peers, and then you put in your preferences, and then someone else says, okay, well, this is what you get. And I'd put that down as a first preference with, say, intelligence as my second.
Why did you want to work with the special forces?
Oh, because they're doing important things and they're really interesting people. I had met them through the process of them interviewing to see if they could go on selection courses. They were just really fun, interesting people. So, yeah, I just wanted to go and see what it was all about and try and support them.
You went along to the training camps. Tell me about that. Was that something you had to do or something you decided would be helpful?
So I was required to be on their board of studies where they talk about who will stay and continue on through the selection process and who won't. And I decided that if I was going to do that, I needed to be there a lot. So I set my week up that I could do 3 days in the office and I would do 4 days down in Singleton watching what they were doing. And it was like having a front row seat at the Olympics. I have never seen people do things like this before.
Like what?
Multiple rounds of this process of, you know, push-ups, sit-ups and a 2.4K run after they had not had food and sleep for 2 days. And some of them are still doing 175 push-ups before they drop, carrying incredible weights, building things, just these huge feats of endurance, but also with cognitive load. It's incredible. At one point, the man who is now my best friend at the time did not understand why I was there and did not want me there. And I turned to him, this is a terrible rookie mistake, and I was like, you need to stop. These people are going to be injured. And he used some serious profanity toward me. And we've been friends ever since.
That's so interesting, though, because, of course, coming out of standard psychological training, you're watching people be pushed deliberately beyond what they think they can endure.
Oh, they were going to die. They didn't. And do you know what's interesting? Sweat smells different when people are, when they've got adrenaline going through their body. So they would like do this stuff and then shove them in a room that I had to sit in. And it's this like sweet, nasty smell.
Sweat smells different.
It smells different.
Is your takeaway.
Yeah.
What were you learning that selectors were looking for in terms of the psychology and character of these soldiers?
Oh, so character is very interesting. At one point, when they had gone through this very intensive experience of sleep and food deprivation, someone had to plan the next activity that the soldiers were going to participate in. And so they said to the leader, well, we're going to give you food because you need your brain to be working. And the unspoken test was, does he share it? Yeah, which was really interesting. And he did, and it gave me goosebumps. And that's exactly what you're looking for.
What separated the people, from your perspective looking on, what separated the people who ended up being selected to join the special forces from those who didn't?
It's not the fitness and it's not the smarts. It's absolutely the tenacity. It's the people who thought, there is nothing else for me. It is this, or I probably won't even continue in the military. There was no question in them about, if it gets to this point, I'll go. These were people who were hiding injuries. They would do anything just to keep going. And from what I then saw going on, because they went through some horrific things while I was posted there, that's absolutely what you needed.
Your first deployment with the Special Forces was to Afghanistan in 2010.
Mm.
What happened not long after you arrived at the base?
A helicopter crashed and 3 men were killed and 7 were very, very seriously wounded. Yeah.
And what was your role there as a psychologist in that situation?
My initial role was just to do the psychological screens as they were leaving the country, but they still had a good month and a half to go at that point. And so it morphed into doing the critical incident response about, you know, what would we do? And usually the advice is we keep them there, we keep them going on operations no matter what. Kind of like, you know, getting someone back on the horse. But this was a special circumstance. And at that time, we decided they actually needed to be able to come home and go to their friends' funerals. And their families needed that as well, because, you know, this was something we hadn't seen in the Australian military in a long, long, long time. And, you know, what they had to do out there in order to keep themselves safe, make sure that the helicopter wasn't, you know, captured by the Taliban and used for intelligence purposes or things like that, was really significant. And at one point, because there's a fire then burning in the helicopter and these guys have got out to save their lives and save other people's lives, then the rounds are firing off at them because of the heat from the fire. It's pretty significant. People who were wounded were also working on other people to save their lives.
Now, these are people who've been selected, as you were describing, precisely because of their very special characteristics, you know, mentally, physically. So what are the flags for you that someone's not coping? Because I imagine their level of coping or their manner of coping would be so different from someone like me anyway. So how can you tell, wait a minute, we're out of the bounds of what's going to be okay for them having gone through an experience like that?
Well, I used to talk to them about it and say, you know, I'm not a human lie detector and I am just going to ask you honestly. And it's a choose your own adventure situation, because if you want to withhold this stuff from me and not get the help, then the trajectory is not as good as if you get it early. But I respect your decision because you're an adult and look what we're asking you to do, you know. So I felt that it was my job just to document as heavily as I could everything they'd been through, so that in future screens, if I wasn't doing them, someone would know that and be able to use that collateral in their background. But you can't force them to tell you something. And if you do, they will close down more. So you really just have to be looking at it. And then, you know, I was paying attention to things back in Australia, like what was going on socially, what am I hearing about incidents that were happening out on the drink, and what am I hearing about people's relationships, and just noticing that and using it as gentle encouragement. I was always very social, walking up and down the breezeway, being at PT, chatting to people, you know, noticing things like that to try and feed it in.
Is it a case, Louise, that for people like that, the moment of extreme trauma and perhaps immediate aftermath is where they're really good at coping.
Yes, but that's also true of people who have PTSD. So you can have PTSD and be unable to function in a shopping centre at Christmas time or even during the year. But if an accident happened beside you or if you're in a tsunami in Fiji, that's the person you want to be with. Right? Because PTSD, we call it a disorder because it is different to normal functioning, but it's actually incredibly helpful for people who are going through a really difficult or tough time. It's just not helpful the rest of the time.
And so for you, when you were on the base and there wasn't the midst of a critical incident such as this crash, what was daily life like for you?
In that two-year period, daily life was really hard, actually, because everything happened so early in my tenure there, and there were so many people who died along the way or were wounded that I pretty much worked 7 days a week the whole time I was there, which is not dissimilar to those men. So you're not kind of feeling hard done by. But, yeah, it would be a combination of getting what you need to do done at work, managing the relationships between the different companies and what they needed, visiting the hospital, you know, checking in with the padre. And we had a lady who was a bit equivalent to a social worker there who was doing some incredible things. And then trying to maybe go forward and do some extra things like standardize how they measure people on selection rather than just through personal opinion.
Where were you living?
It was in Tarancot, and the Special Forces are kind of a little bit removed from everyone else. And so I was just living in there with them, and sometimes in these hardened containers, sometimes in this wooden building. It was really difficult to get accommodation. So for periods of time, because they would have things like, oh, you can't go out into the rest of the base without a rate whistle and a second person, I would just stay in my office, which wasn't hardened. It was a bit cheeky, but...
You mean sleep there?
I couldn't be bothered. I couldn't be bothered. And I really thought, like, what are the chances? I hope my mum doesn't hear that.
Were you scared for your own safety at times in terms of enemy fire or any of that?
I mean, I wasn't scared because I think we were all under the same level of risk. But there were other things going on, like the risk of men, as, you know, can happen in Australian society, and it was happening there and it was problematic.
Were there many other women working on that base when you were there?
There probably would have been about 10%, so there were enough. But the military's response to women being at risk is always don't walk around at night, as opposed to let's make it safer.
You're describing the extremity of combat that these soldiers, the special forces in particular, were encountering in Afghanistan. And then your job was to sit and listen to however much detail they were willing to share with you. I mean, the term that gets used for that now is referred trauma, of just hearing other people's descriptions of violent, terrible experiences. What kind of effect was that having on your own psychology?
At the time... at the time I would have said none, but of course it did have a significant effect on me, and it was really difficult to sit there and, you know, be holding that for people and be conscious that it, like, this is sad for me too, because I cared about those people, and it's horrific to hear some of the level of detail. They're quite desensitized in a lot of ways. So, you know, there was one gentleman who had been shot in the head. And at a point later, he had the video of it, and he was like, Lou, like, come and see the video. And I was like, no, I don't want to see you get shot in the head. I'm so glad that you are okay now. And, you know, that is wonderful. That's all I need to know.
What about when you were yourself back home for periods? How was your day-to-day life changing? You know, even if you're just looking back, seeing what was happening in ways that you were maybe coping with that stress or trauma?
I mean, I was definitely drinking heavily, and the culture was that. So there's a combination of a part of you being aware of it and a part of you really just normalizing it. I'm just one of the, like, I'm, you know, this is all fine. But I was aware that I wasn't sleeping. I was aware that I was, you know, very small, that I was pretty cranky. I was really touchy, lots of things like that.
So given that you're feeling crankier and you're not sleeping well and you're drinking too much, you make this decision to go off to Bali to do a yoga course for a month. How did that go?
I did. It didn't go great. Sarah, it didn't.
What kind of energy were you in that field of yogis?
According to her, I was the angriest person that had come into their shared space. And even though I passed all my tests, I was asked to leave on the last day. Because
you failed your yoga course.
Failed it because I was too angry. And I responded by being very angry in response. Like, just to validate everything she'd said. And I had no insight into that until much later. I really didn't.
So was there a point where you knew it was time for you to step away from this work with the army? How did that decision come?
There were two things. And they were TV related, interestingly. So I was watching TV and that ad came on for Commonwealth Bank at the time where Toni Collette was reading a poem about Cannes and I just started crying. And then another ad for sorbent toilet paper where there's a little toddler and he's going to go fall on his bottom, but the dog pushes the toilet paper under and I was just bawling.
Okay, so why is that a clue to leave the army from a psychological point of view? Responding to carefully, you know, emotionally manipulative advertisements. What was that telling you?
Well, I was very vulnerable. Like, wowee. You know, if I can sit there and listen to some of the stuff I'd listened to with, you know, holding myself together quite stoically and then I'm seeing a baby fall on some toilet paper and I'm just, like, crying, I think that's a big indicator.
Right, so you don't let yourself have the emotions where they're appropriate. You have them, they find their way out in other contexts.
Leak out.
TV commercials were too dangerous.
Too dangerous. Even to this day, I can't go to my kids' assembly and hear the national anthem without crying. And they also have a school song, which is pretty terrible, and I just bawl. It's got actions. Oh.
So what work did you find yourself doing as a psychologist after stepping away from that role with the army?
More trauma work. I was typecast and I typecast myself, but I got into, you know, sort of more of a management role and I thought that that would be okay and I would be able to protect myself from it. But instead, these high-profile things were happening. Like, I started working there just after the Lynn siege had happened. So then I needed to, you know, assist in doing all the follow-ups to the people who were in the businesses surrounding that, not involved in the siege itself. I had to go and respond to the death of a New South Wales police worker who was shot and killed outside the Liverpool police station, and unfortunately be part of the delivery of the death message to his wife. And it just, you know, and during that time I was also doing my placements for my clinical master's. So I would do that Monday to Friday and then on the weekend I would go and work in this child-based clinic.
There was a lot happening in your personal life at this time too, Louise. You got married, but then not long after received a diagnosis of cervical cancer. How did that play out?
Well, that was another schmozzle. I refer to my life as a glorious schmozzle, just to be a bit positive about it. So I had had some ongoing problems for some time and I'd kept going to the doctor to, like, get my pap smear done, but they couldn't do it for whatever reason. And when they finally did, I went and saw my GP and she said, look, you've had these low-level changes that you probably heard of as a woman. You just need to go to the gynecologist. They're going to deal with that. It's not cancer, don't worry. And I remember her saying, it's not cancer. Cool, great, I'm chill. So I go to the gynecologist and she says, right, okay, what are we going to do about this cancer? And I go, I don't have cancer. Right? She goes, yes, you do. And this is just before the Easter long weekend. So I leave there and I'm confused. And because I was in, like, a bit of shock about it, I don't have my husband there and I didn't ask the right questions. I didn't write anything down or ask for anything written down. So for the whole of the Easter long weekend, I was like, am I being a drama queen? And so I went back to my GP who said, you don't have cancer. And I was like, well, I don't know. Can you ring her? Like, what's going on? And then she looked at the pathology report she'd gotten, and the SYN 3 and 4 changes I had were bolded, but the part where I had cancer was not. So she had missed it. Now, to be fair to her, she's a busy lady. You know, the GPs are under-resourced and underpaid. And she had already done the right thing by referring me. So that was okay. And then we went, then I took my husband the next time and we went to the gynecologist and she explained, no, not only is this cancer, but like it's bad and you need to have a radical hysterectomy and they'll decide in the theatre whether they take your lymph nodes. And so before that, you could do a round of IVF if you want to have kids.
Just one round?
Just one. You only have a month. We'll give you a month, but that's it. You've got to get it done. And my husband at the time was off in Wagga doing a military course. So it was like me on FaceTime to my best friend, Sashine, because I was too weak to give myself a needle and she would have to talk me through it at night. She would be like, you have to, like, pinch your tummy skin. She would be like, just start by punching it. Just give it a punch. See, it can't be worse than a punch. And I would be like, okay. And I would eventually just get this stupid needle in me. She went through that with me for a month.
And so was it successful, that one chance you had at IVF before the hysterectomy?
It was, yeah. We got a couple of embryos out and we, you know, thought, okay, well, we'll think about what we're going to do with those later. And then I just launched into, I was doing 5 days a week of radiation every morning. And then one day I would do chemo.
And the results of that were good. The treatment got you where it needed to be. Yeah. And so how soon after that finished did you and your husband decide to look for a surrogate?
I wanted to start looking while we were having treatment. I was suddenly desperate and that was really tricky because I remember crying to my oncological gynecologist. So you can imagine how smart she is. And there is this inverse relationship between intelligence and social skills. And I was like crying to her like, oh, I'm so sad. I'm not going to be able to have a baby. And she goes, get a dog. And I was like, I think she's a wonderful woman.
But that's not what you needed to hear.
I eventually beat her down and convinced her to let me start the surrogacy process before 2 years had passed.
How did you find a surrogate? Where?
Interestingly, there are conferences that you can go to and the agencies advertise and we went to one and they advertised and we thought Ukraine sounds really good because what you pay them goes direct to the surrogate, not through the agencies. You pay the agency fee and then you get to pay direct to the surrogate, so you feel like she's getting it. And with what we were going to pay her, she could buy an apartment in cash, which is a huge deal in Ukraine, huge. So that's what we decided to do and we met Olga.
And so you link up with the surrogate in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. You are in Australia with these embryos. How did the embryos get to Olga?
They put them in an esky with dry ice in an overhead compartment.
In a regular aeroplane?
In a regular aeroplane with a little note that says biological material.
Wow. And successfully they arrived, yeah, and were implanted, yeah, in Olga. And then how much communication did you have with her during the process of the pregnancy?
So we would message, you know, thank goodness that like that's available now. And it wasn't until after the children were born that I found out, because of her age, she actually speaks Russian. So I was converting from English to Ukrainian and she was converting from Ukrainian to Russian. That is why we really didn't understand a lot about each other.
How far into the pregnancy did you learn that Olga was carrying twins?
I remember flying to Melbourne and seeing my boss and running up to him because people knew my story, being like, we're pregnant. And he was like, oh, my God, how far along? And I was like, 11 days. He goes, you've gone early. And I was like, I feel confident. Like, this is going to work out.
And
yeah.
Were you excited by twins?
Yes, I was excited by twins. I was excited by everything. I was thrilled. I found out in our house in Thirroul, and my husband was at the gym. It's like a 6-minute drive, but I decided to drive to the gym to tell him. And I had already called like 5 people. When I got there, he said, look, it's very early. Maybe we shouldn't tell other people. And I was like, it's too late. Everyone knows.
So excitement levels were high.
Yeah.
What phone call did you get around 3 months before your little twins were due to be born?
Well, she did get placenta previa, which we knew meant that it was going to be higher risk. We found out that they'd been born. We didn't have a lot of information. We knew that they were in NICU, but that Olga was okay, thank goodness. That was really important. And they seemed to be okay.
So did that mean you were straight away getting a bag on a flight? How quickly could you get to
Ukraine? Overnight. I got on a flight the very next day, which was the soonest flight we could get. I was running around buying preemie baby stuff and just packing a bag. My husband had to stay in Wollongong because he was finishing his final placement in the hospitals for his medical degree. So this is like a constant theme, right? Going solo and dealing with this stuff. And I arrived there. It was tricky to get into the country.
What happened at the airport?
I didn't have a visa, and it says you can get a visa on arrival, but they don't mean that. What they mean is we will yell at you and make you wait hours and hours while you cry as though you've just seen a Commonwealth Bank ad. Then we will let you through. So I eventually got to them because the agency picked me up. I dropped my gear in an apartment and then they took me straight to the hospital. And it is not a hospital that looks like our hospitals, and it is not a setup that looks like our setups.
What did you see, Louise, when you walked into the room where your babies were for the first time?
My God, they were tiny. There were cords everywhere. There were monitors. They, you know, didn't have their eyes open. They were too small for everything that they had on.
Could you touch them, hold them?
No, you weren't allowed to do that yet. So I could just look at them through the box. It was either that day or maybe the next day that I got to see the doctor. And being a Soviet country, they are, you know, just much more forthright and stoic about things. And they just said, look, these kids are going to die.
They're going to die, they said that.
Yep, don't bother getting your husband to come over. It'll be too late. And stop crying. Stop crying. Don't cry in front of the babies.
Louise, this is the most distressing, traumatizing experience. When did that start to change from that really bald assessment that your little kids weren't going to make it?
Oh, not for a long time, because, you know, they were having these scans on their brain about how much brain damage there were and how much additional hydrocephalus was there and all of these things. So, you know, it was at least 2 weeks before they sort of said, well, look, we might be able to put in a shunt for Ivy, but then she'll need like to have this PDA closure of her heart, and the chances of her getting through that are very low. So maybe this one will live, but that one will die. They used to be like that. It was really, really tough.
Were you in crisis operation mode? How were you handling those first days and weeks when you look back?
I was just crying on FaceTime to my parents and Dale. And then I would just go into the hospital. So it was about 7.5 kilometres from my accommodation to the hospital, and I walked because that felt like something to do. So we'd walk first thing in the morning, get something to eat outside the hospital, go in. I would sit there for the whole day, like just reading a book. I had these beautiful little sound machines and light machines that I would play for them. And, you know, I had heard that it's good to play classical music, and I was doing that. And then I would just, at the end of the day, I would just go home, order a pizza.
How were you being asked to help care for them?
In the beginning, they were nurses in the NICU, and then when they went to special care, I had to move into the hospital for the next sort of nearly 2 months and live there. And so my job was everything. My job was to put in their nasogastric tubes, to carry out the hydrocephalus that they had siphoned out of Ivy's skull, to go from pharmacy to pharmacy. One time I went 14 kilometres in one day to all these different pharmacies, because you had to buy everything from the paper towel, the hand wash, the medication, the aprons that the nurses wore, and supply that for the hospital.
You had to do that yourself?
Yeah, and they would just write me a list in Ukrainian, and I would just take the list to these different places, and people would give it to me and tick it off for me. And I would just go. And one time I couldn't get Ivy's. She was having infantile seizures. So I couldn't get the anti-seizure medication. I was really upset. And my mum and dad had arrived at that point, and they went out to just at night just to go see if they could find me any. And my mum realised she only had her like long johns on. She didn't put real pants on. My parents twice got into Ubers, and like, bless them, like they're in their 60s. Got into Ubers and accidentally ordered them to a place in Russia instead of Ukraine. And thank goodness the Uber driver was like, that is not where you want to go.
And in terms of paying for their medical care, which of course wasn't something you had planned for, was that something you were having to organise up front?
That was another moment of anger for me, because we were paying regularly $2,000, $2,000, $2,000 that you would have to get out of all these different ATMs because it's so much money over there. And then at one point they came in and, you know, it's just culturally, it's a different environment. And they said, you need to give us $10,000 or we're switching off the life support. And I just went ballistic, and I picked up this wad of cash that I have and I threw it at them, and I like told them to F off. And I like closed the door and wouldn't let them in. And so at that point we were considering whether or not we could just take the kids and run to Moldova, where we've got reciprocal Medicare, to get treatment there, because I was just really frightened. I think they thought that we had just endless amounts of money, which we didn't, because it cost, you know, nearly, the whole process cost nearly $150,000 in the end.
You spent 3 months with the twins in hospital. What milestones felt most significant to you as their mum as they got bigger and stronger?
Oh, definitely when I could stop tube feeding them. That was incredible. I mean, of course, the first time I could hold them, that was amazing. I really needed it. I didn't have a connection to them. I hadn't carried them. I had this barrier up in my heart and my mind that they were going to die. So I really needed to, like, feel them. And I loved that. And, you know, to this day, I love listening to them sleep at night, and I love kissing them on the cheek when they sleep. And yeah, I just love knowing that they're there and they're alive.
Despite those doctors' pronouncements, you did bring two little babies back with you to Australia.
Yeah.
What kind of treatments did they need once they were on home turf?
So when we got home, they each had 7 different specialists. Ivy had to have her shunt replaced when she got here. And then we did 1,200 hours of speech therapy, OT, physio to get them to where they're at now. So thank you to the NDIS and just our hospital systems, which were incredible, really incredible.
As time went on, Louise, you must have had this huge gratitude, relief that they were alive and that you were safe and you were back home. You and their dad split up, and you know, you had been carrying so much, just what you've described from your time with the Defence Force in war zones, and this huge stress of having your babies arrive early in another country.
Yeah.
Then a marriage breakup. How are you doing?
This has been, yeah, probably the hardest. We finally got to a time where I felt confident. So the kids are, not only are they going to survive, but they're thriving, which is something that we never expected. And then I could turn toward my marriage, and instead that wasn't going to be the case. And it was an incredible heartbreak and betrayal and things like that. So then when I had that opportunity, I think I got so low, and it was, I think, the lowest I've been in my life.
And was that more when the kids weren't with you, when you
yes.
were alone, those weeks when you didn't have that care responsibility?
Yeah. There's something about when you've got them and that's your purpose for being, and they give you this love. And, you know, my son turned to me at one point and he said, Mom, I'm going to love you forever. You know, I will always be here. Don't you worry. And I'm like, God, well, you're 5. How are you even saying it's beautiful? But then, yeah, when I didn't have them, it would just be so hard. And I've always found that work is a real purpose for me, because I adore my clients. I see only traumatized people, and they're the best people. So, you know, I really thank God for my clients, because they kept me going. But it also showed to me that I needed to do that same thing for myself, or I just wasn't going to make it.
What did you try earlier this year? What kind of therapy? Having spoken to psychologists, psychiatrists, and tried various different approaches to work on your own healing, what did you decide to try?
So I had been doing EMDR for a period of time, which is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, and it activates that part of the brain that allows you to store the memory in the past, as opposed to the way that your brain is trying to deal with it as though it's a current threat to you. And that was working, but my mood was just so low. I felt like I was waking up every day at negative 100 and just clawing my way to get to zero at best. And so I had seen a couple of clients use ketamine therapy, either for pain or for mood. And I thought, you know what? I need to do this. And I took a month off work. And I went in twice a week for the first month, and then after that it spreads out a bit.
What is ketamine and ketamine therapy, and how does it help mood?
Yeah, most people would know it as like a horse tranquilizer or a party drug.
Something that Elon Musk takes.
It's in nasal spray form that I take it, and it is like a hallucinogen. And so the idea is that it resets that HPA axis, which is where you get your dopamine, your serotonin, your norepinephrine, your oxytocin, and allows that to start functioning normally again. So you take these nasal sprays, you sit in a chair, and things get wild.
Really? What do you remember happening in your first session?
My teeth taste like Big Macs, and I was licking them. I love a Big Mac. I worked at McDonald's in my teenage years. I put on significant weight. I still love a Big Mac. I tell all my clients, a great way to let your emotions out, you just get a Big Mac and you just cry in the car park. And for as long as it takes to eat the Big Mac, and then you go, all right, deep breath. Let's go about your day.
So ketamine brought you the big mouth into
me
your
the big
own
Mac
teeth.
Into therapy, yeah. Like, isn't that pretty cool? I would get, like, obsessed with my hand or just, like, look at it and be like, it's so cool. You know, like how babies do? There's that milestone called regarding the hand, and they see the hand and they're like, look what I can do. And I would feel that way. And this incredible nurse, Walter, just, like, watching me go from, I think I look like just a normal conservative middle-aged woman to just like this rat bag who's like, I think I should dance, Walter. And he's like, I think you should sit down.
So how does that help with mood though? I mean, is this the hallucinations, the sort of altered mind states that last for a few hours, I guess?
Yeah, it just lasts for a few hours. But what it's allowing the brain to do is have basically, it's like turning the computer off and on again, you know.
You're not revisiting the source of trauma or depressive incidents, you're just...
No, you try and stay well away from that. I did have like a couple of, I guess what other people would call like a bad trip where I was very upset and emotional, and so I learned how to just keep myself in that positive mindset and just go to happy things. You know, like, I mean, Taylor Swift songs aren't always happy, but they're very meaningful. But like really great music, you know, sometimes some colouring, sometimes just watching comedy, just stuff like that.
And so did you notice your mood be different in everyday life after the drug had worn off in that intense phase?
Yes. It has changed my whole life. It
How
has
quickly?
Saved my life.
How quickly did
now,
that change?
It's different for everyone, but for me it absolutely worked at about week three. You immediately notice it in the hours afterwards and feel better and lighter, but then it kind of creeps back, right? And so that's why we have to create this new pattern in the brain of, hey, no, we're allowed to let this out. We don't need to metabolize all of that and take it away. And, you know, my mum has said, I got it done. I started, I think, in June or July. So I guess we're about 5 months in now. And my mum has said, like, you're your old self. You know, and I think, this is a bit sad, but I think what she means is like pre-army, you know, like we're talking a while ago.
So all that anger that had been this big defence for you from the army, where is it?
I don't know, but I don't miss it. Yeah.
With ketamine therapy, do you continue taking the ketamine indefinitely, or is it like an intensive period and it's a reset?
Yeah, it's largely a reset. And because it's new, they don't have the long-term protocols. So I decided just to do it for a couple of months, and I probably would have kept doing it, but over longer, with longer intervals in between. But I've since taken on a much larger custody of my kids to help out their dad. So I don't have time to do it, and I feel okay.
You said you still work, or you work really only with people who've experienced trauma. So still a lot of soldiers, veterans.
Yeah.
Why did you want to return to that work, Louise, rather than something completely different given what you've experienced?
I think to lack a bit of humility, because I'm good at it, but also what I have seen from traumatized people, and, you know, sometimes we're talking about kids who grew up in a household that was, you know, just full of addiction, and they had no positive role models. And then they just decided, they just woke up one morning and went, I have to get out of here, or I'm not going to make it. And they go they take themselves to a halfway house and put themselves in school. And they come to me as an adult. I absolutely want to treat them and give them the best future there is, because that level of survival, I think it kind of mimics, you know, what I saw in the special forces, just like people who are determined to survive at whatever it takes.
Are you scared at all that being present for all of those stories of trauma again might spark the kind of depression, grief in you that it has in the past?
No, because we do it differently now. So when we did it back in the days when I was in the military, we did a thing called prolonged exposure, which is incredibly vicariously traumatizing. EMDR is much, much less so. And then I also have learned over the years better self-care, better boundaries, things like that.
What does that look like for you? What are some of the things you do to make sure that you're going okay?
I have an admin assistant who will not allow me to work beyond a certain workload, who forces me to take periods of leave, who won't say yes to, otherwise I would schedule on my lunch breaks, I would do all of that sort of thing. And then because I have the kids, you know, after school we've got to get in the pool and we've got to go and play, and I love doing that. I now play golf. I used to be forced into golf when I was in the military. It's like a thing that they like to do, and I was like, this sucks. And then I started getting lessons, and actually it's awesome, and the outfits are on point, which I like. There's a lot that's good about it. So I have a really full life now.
And I wonder, I mean, I don't know if this sounds like too much of a cliche, but having seen the worst that can happen and having experienced that incredibly distressing thing around your own kids, does it leave you with a different sort of appreciation just for the everyday, ordinary bits of life?
Yes. And I've read research that sort of talks about, like, oh, someone has a heart attack and the changes that take place in terms of their lifestyle and their appreciation of life usually only last about 12 months. But I have been lucky enough to have a succession of events that lead me to, like, really and truly, I love looking at my garden. I love playing with the dog. I love seeing my friends. I love laughing. I love hearing the kids laugh when I'm upstairs and they're downstairs, and you just hear them like really belly laughing and having fun with each other. I just, you know, my daughter's about to get, here I go, daughter's about to get like the citizen award in her class, and I just, I'm beyond proud.
Will there be happy tears at that ceremony?
They were just reading the email. I can barely talk to their teachers without being like, I'm just so proud of them. They've been through so much. People are probably sick of me banging on about it, but I don't care. They have.
You've had a life of these big chapters and big adventures. How do you imagine the next couple of decades?
I hope it is incredibly uneventful. I hope nothing at all happens.
I wish that for you too.
Thank you.
Louise, I have really loved meeting you. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Thanks for having me.
Psychologist and Army veteran Louise O'Sullivan was my guest on Conversations today. This episode was produced by Jen Leake and recorded on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. Our executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.